Welcome to Gay Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Justine, my interview today is with somebody that you recommended their book earlier this year. Do you have a guess as to who it is?
I've recommended a lot of books, Brad. I mean, I think with my end of the year thing, I've probably recommended close to 70 books now.
All right. This one is
And I've awesome. Never done more. I have only done a couple authors more than once. So we've got a big selection.
Yeah, I won't put you on the spot to have to figure it out. That's pretty lengthy. And I'm not going to give you hints.
And I certainly don't want to, you know, diss somebody who I don't mention.
Yes, of course. So it's Austin Thomas Burton.
Oh, I like his books.
Yes. And
his book. He's only written one.
Yes. He's working on one to release soon, which you'll hear in the interview. He also wanted to let you know, which you'll also hear in the interview. He thanks you very much. It meant a lot to him to have that recommendation.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
So you made him a happy man, and you'll hear he says thank you.
I like to encourage new authors. There was one author I recommend, and I won't tell you who. His book was several years old, and it had done so badly, and he'd spent so much on it that he had really just given up. And I wish I had found his book sooner and sent him some encouragement sooner, because it was a good book that we never saw more of.
That's sad.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's always good to like get those books early, order them early, let the authors know you like them. It does a world of good for the reading public.
And I've heard a lot from authors recently asking about sending books in for you to look at. And I'm like, there is no harm in doing so because they're not reviews. So Justine is not going to come on and say, your book sucks.
That's right.
She will give you a recommendation if there's a star. And I thought I put my phone on mute and it is ringing right now.
Oh, my. We got all the interruptions on my side packed away, and then all of a sudden your phone goes.
Okay, it just died. You know, I think people are probably tired of listening to us. You should tell us who you're going to talk about today.
I am talking about a novella because, you know, this past week it has been full-blown election coverage that I really did not have the time and attention for a full book. So I found a novella by Anne Apteker, and it is called A Taco, A T-Bird, A Beretta, and One Furious Night.
Well, that's a long title.
That's a long title, yeah. And it is part of the Guns and Tacos series, and it's book 10 of that series. But each of the books is a standalone written by a different author. It's one of those collections of books that authors put together, all about the similar theme.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the authors, I mean, all of the authors are good. Many of them are familiar. And most of the time, the authors are within the same genre or, you know, within the same style. So if you like one of the books, you can pick up the others and enjoy them just as much.
Cool. I had Anne Apteker on a while back, not too long ago, and I really enjoyed it. So I'm glad to hear you're going to do her book today. Do tell.
So it's a short novella. It's about 15,000 words, and it is a thrilling novella because it starts out with this woman who goes up to the taco truck and gets a Beretta and
a
gets
burrito?
In her T-board.
A burrito?
A Beretta.
A Beretta. Okay.
The gun.
I was trying boom, to correct boom. You, but okay. I'm sorry I tried to correct you. Go on.
Well, glad you clarified. She gets a Beretta and then gets in her T-bird and goes out and seeks revenge. And along the way, we get the story of why she's seeking revenge. To me, it didn't really matter why she was seeking because I was so sucked into the plot where she just, you know, tracks somebody, goes to this place, gets these people, goes to that place, and just goes from beginning to end, exciting scene to exciting scene. Doesn't linger too long in any one spot, and it is a great short read, guns and blazing all the way through. It's a thrilling recommendation.
Good, we got a recommendation, and it shouldn't take you too long because it's a novella.
Yeah, yeah, it was. And believe me, if the election has left you in the mood to shoot people up, this will probably take care of a lot of that urge.
We all need that.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so let me just say from Requeered Tales, people can pre-order The Death of a Constant Lover by Lev Raphael with a foreword by Brad Shreve himself. And we want to really, if you support Lev Raphael or Requeered Tales or the marvelous Brad Shreve, pre-order it so it gets, front page attention from Amazon that first day. And while you're waiting for it, you can pick up anything from our back catalog, along with today's Rough and Ready novella. I recommend the Scottish Noir series, Jazz Anderson, with Freeform being the first book by Jack Dixon. That's got the same gritty, go through the world with a fair amount of anger.
And I'm going to tell everybody, you got to read The Death of a Constant Lover.
Yes. Yes.
So thank you, Requeered Tales, for asking me.
Then thank you for doing it for us. I think that's all we have for this week. We can let people get back to the election and, look forward to hearing us next week.
Okay. That was very quick. And hopefully they won't have too much election news by the time this comes out. Yeah. Think positive here.
That's right. Think positive.
All right, Justine. See you next week.
See you next week.
Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Game Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, GameMysteryPodcast.com. Longtime San Diego resident Austin Thomas Burton grew up the youngest of seven in a small college town that couldn't decide if it was Southern, Midwestern, or just wouldn't fit anywhere. That static childhood resulted in a restless need to see the country and the world. Burton currently lives in a historic Georgian Revival house built in 1897 in Toledo, Ohio's Old West End, with his husband and two spoiled basset hounds. Sadly, the house is not haunted as promised. Well, that would be disappointing to be promised a haunted house, and it doesn't come through.
I agree. That was, I can't say it was the major selling point of the house, but it was one of the attractive points. We've since found out who the ghost supposedly is, but she hasn't talked to us at all.
Well, give it time. Maybe she's shy.
It is a funny story. We should get into it at some point if we have time.
Sure, sure. And first, welcome to the Game Mystery Podcast.
Thanks very much, and thank you for having me.
I want to start by saying great job for being one of Justine's weekly recommendations. I think it was in May. She really enjoyed your book.
I that took me completely by surprise, and it was my first really... how do I put this? The first review that really hit me and said, oh my God, I've actually published a book that someone likes.
Well, she only does her book recommendations if she thinks it's... We don't do reviews here. It's a recommendation. So she only does those that she considers a five. So you can feel good about that.
She gave me a particular piece of that she found particularly good about my writing, and that's... when I get down on myself, I think about that. I know that sounds cliche, doesn't it? But it's kind of a treasured moment. It's a big deal. So thank you, Justine.
She listens in, so she'll hear that. Now, that book was Fool's Rush In?
Correct.
And that's your first novel, correct?
It's my first novel. I've had a couple of, I don't know if you want to call them maxi short stories or very short novellas, none of them were actually LGBT focused. They all grew out of a 2-year period where I was working for a department store in New York, which sadly has just become a victim of the pandemic, Century 21 department stores. I was subletting from a friend in Brooklyn. So it was quite a subway ride, and You know, when you're forced in public transportation to just sort of sit there and be quiet and look around, the wheels are always turning. And New York's one of those cities that has constant input. So I was seeing so many things that were new to me, but very, very old. And they all just told great stories. And I was literally forced to write some of them down. But Fools Rush In is the first book in hopefully a series that had a similar kind of inspiration. Living in San Diego as long as my husband and I had, especially downtown. And we lived downtown very near Balboa Park when it was not stylish to do so. And there is a hotel, the El Cortez. It's been famous for, well over half a century. And it was deserted when we lived there. Various attempts to restore it, resurrect it, had failed. And it just sat there quietly, looming over, you know, that south part of downtown. And I just thought to myself, you know, if they ever get in to restore it or do something, what are they going to find? And that just worked in my head until, well, I had to tell the story about what they would find and why.
And we're going to get to that, aren't we? So the protagonist in the novel is Horatio Rush Storms.
Yes.
Would you tell us about him?
Sure. And maybe part of the intro to it is the fact that most all the names I use are, in this particular case, I had a great uncle, Horatio. And Storms is actually my paternal grandmother's maiden name. So there was a person called Horatio Storms. But
it's an Austin name, by the way. Horatio is pretty cool.
It's great, right? And his nickname was Rush. It was Uncle Rush, as far as I ever knew. I didn't know his name was actually Horatio until, I think my dad told me at one point, and I thought, who are you talking about? So that's playing into the title, right? Fools Rush In,
mm-hmm.
Which I don't know if that was obvious enough. But Rush has some problems. He was almost a policeman. He genetically is predisposed to be a cop is the way he sees it, because his grandfather was a very successful one, and his dad then. Not as successful a cop, but in a less, honest way, I suppose, he was successful in his own right. But just before he graduated the academy, he didn't come out. He was sort of forced out of the closet, and it ruined his career and ruined his relationship with his dad. And ruined his relationship with the other cadet. So he didn't really know what to do with himself. So his grandfather took him under his wing. He had left San Diego and gone on to San Francisco. And he learned to be a private detective because that's what his grandfather had done. So Rush doesn't really make, I don't want to say he doesn't make good choices. He falls into things as they happen. And he doesn't really have much of a direction in life, but he tries his best once he falls into things to do the right thing.
Well, that sounds a lot like my life.
In some ways, it's mine too. So, you know, there's always a lot of yourself in what you write, I think.
So when you mentioned the struggles he had in the academy, what era does this book take place in?
That's a very good point. It's set in the same era as when I lived downtown, so the early 1990s.
Okay.
Some of the things as they happened had to be sort of massaged to fit into that area. So I've never been extremely specific about it, but safe to say between 91 and 94 is when all this happens.
Well, it's time for your sales pitch. You told us just a little bit about Rush. You can give us some more about him and tell us a story about Fools Rush In.
Oh, sure. There is a, you know, oddly, you'll be shocked to know that there is a derelict Grand Hotel in downtown San Diego that Rush sees as he drives into work. And when, from a variety of sources, I won't give away too much, he suddenly is dragged into the fact that a body's been found, but the body isn't recent. It's been there a very, very long time. How's the best way to put this? He winds up in a situation where everyone is asking him, in some cases sort of forcing him, to investigate this. And he doesn't have any interest in investigating things anymore. he's become a bar owner because his dad died and left him what is really a de facto bar. But he knows nothing about owning or much less running a bar. And he financially is not doing well. So it's certainly not something he should be focusing his time on. But on the other hand, he finds out that part of his own family history is wrapped up in this particular problem. So he gives in and learns a great deal about his father, his grandfather, and ultimately people that he knows may be more involved than he's really comfortable with. So I don't know, is that too vague or is that...
No. I think that's enough to get us going. We know it's a hotel and there's definitely going to be a body in it. So it's really tough to be a writer to try and tell the story without giving too much away when you're a mystery writer.
And of course, I want to tell you so much more about it because some of the characters I was surprised at how much I liked and disliked some of the characters. And it's always, you hear, again, a little bit of a cliche about characters writing their own story, but you know, there's a few in there that I was just charmed by. I was very surprised at how much I liked some of the characters I expected to dislike. So,
no, I can relate to that. I've fallen in love with several of my characters. So even the ones that I dislike, I love them for one reason or another.
Do you find it's kind of therapeutic to, you know, put them through their paces and put them in good situations and bad situations?
I love to put characters, and especially my protagonists, into bad situations. I tend to be kind of cruel. They don't always end up, you know, in the final print. But as I'm writing, I tend to beat them up quite a bit. Maybe it's my own form of self-abuse.
There you go. I will say that there are several characters that survived this book that didn't in the first draft, and I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Do you outline?
You know, so my method is it's hardly a method, to be candid with you. Because, you know, I was an English major in college, and so there were ways we were taught to write. And those don't work for me unless I'm doing a research paper, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
For me, I have to see the scene. I do a grand outline, right? But then as I think about each scene, and it's rarely in order, unfortunately, because that would be much easier. It'll pop up in my head when I'm not even thinking about it, about how a character would react, what they would do, what I want to happen, and solving those problems. I kind of feed it all in and let my subconscious process it. And then it'll pop into my head at a certain time when I'm, of course, far away from paper or laptop or anything like that. And I'll see the scene in my head. And once I can visually see the scene, I can write it. And when I've seen the entire scene, I can write it quickly as well. So that's my problem. Because there is a second book underway that I have the outline. I know how everything's going to happen and end. But there's several key scenes that I just can't process right now. And I don't know if that's, you know, I'm not happy with the outline or plot. Because they, you know, they are subject to change like everything. Mm-hmm. Or it's just the current state we're living in.
It's funny because a lot of authors I talked to thought, oh, this pandemic, I thought it was going to be perfect to give me the time to write. But there's just something in the air that just actually making it more difficult, even though you have the time.
Yeah. There's that background hum of tension.
Yeah.
That's just constant. It's low grade, but it's like a very, very distant rake on a chalkboard, I think.
Yeah, it makes it tough. Well, I was asking because you kind of alluded to it. I find it interesting when I start a novel that I have a character in mind, and by the time the book is done, they've completely morphed into somebody different, or a minor character that became a major character, or vice versa. So, and I have to write a strict outline. But that's just the way I get started. But by the end of the book, it may look nothing like my outline. But right. I've got to have that outline to get out the door.
I think especially in anything that has a puzzle to it, there has to be an outline. Otherwise, you wind up at an end that, for whatever reason, blame the pandemic. I've been watching a lot of Poirot lately. and the Ariadne Oliver character, modeled on Agatha herself, she never seems to know what the end of the book is. So she never seems to know how to get there. So she's always puzzling over a solution that doesn't work. So I think that's true of everyone, is that you know how you want it to end, but some things happen that are so good you can't let go of. Mm-hmm. And that just means that the end has to change. My end didn't change from beginning to end in this particular case, but I think it's safe to say that the grand twist, the grand surprise, is not what you expect it to be. So, that's vague enough to not worry anyone. But I've had several readers tell me that they figured it out way ahead, but they didn't see the actual twist coming.
I think actually that's what Justine said, if I recall. I don't remember every book that she talks about, but I could be wrong, but I think she mentioned that. You said you're working on another one. Do you know when we may see that?
Well, about 2 months ago. That was absolutely the plan, was to have it well in advance. Because, we set this interview up some time ago, and I thought, great. That gives me plenty of time to get it ready and at least have it edited and, if not published, ready to go. I'm going to really shoot for the end of the year. That's my current, but that's, how do we call that, a stretch goal? I will be shocked if I finish it by the end of the year. I have it about, I think it's safe to say, about half done, but there's just some major points in it that aren't working out the way I wanted it to.
Yeah.
And we'll see. But I can say that, much to my surprise, the audiobook version is going into production any minute. It's at a weird turn of events where a former colleague of mine, an old friend, we've stayed in contact for off and on for, well over 15 years. Turns out I've always known that he started out as a radio DJ, and he has now been doing commercial voiceovers and audiobooks. And it's just one of those weird circumstances where it works for everyone. Because I hadn't been actively pursuing an audiobook. I personally don't do them, so it's tough for me to get the energy into it. But he's just, I'm so happy with the first few samples we've done. I can't wait to hear how my characters sound. I'm very excited about that.
I'm waiting for mine to come out now.
Oh, that's very cool.
Now, how long ago did Fool's Rush In come out?
It was published, I want to say, May 1st. I think that's correct. You'd think I would have taken some notes, but it was right at the end of April, beginning of May.
Okay. I normally look it up on Amazon, and I didn't note the date, but I knew it was this year sometime. So, it's exciting when you see your book posted on Amazon, and I know you have your audiobook coming in, but the day that the actual book comes in the mail, and you hold that first hard copy in your hand. Tell us about that.
So that's actually a great point, because I will say I had the Kindle version ready to go far before I managed to get the paperback version done. I kept having error after error, and I may very well have published maybe that's why I'm thinking of 2 dates. It may have been the Kindle version was ready before the paperback was. So it was kind of mixed emotions, because one, I was, well, thank God that's done. The second part of it was immediately I was unhappy with my print version. So I had to go back and do more editing, because until I have a physical copy, I sometimes struggle with things, just on a laptop screen as opposed to a physical copy. But I will tell you, it is quite bizarre to put something with your name on your own bookshelf. That was a very, it's a hard to describe moment. I was very, very proud of it, because I actually did something I had been meaning to do well for 20 years. But the other part of it is the kind of kidding myself, like, okay, so that's it? Are you going to do more? And that was really what pushed me to sit down within the next day and spit out the outline for what happens to Rush next. So it was a positive thing, but it was also for me, if you haven't noticed that, there's that always little bit of self-doubt that I use as encouragement, that the propellant to that particular movement.
So your self-doubt actually helps you move forward?
Right. Because if I, you know, like, oh, I can do better than that. I can fix that. That's oddly enough, it's one of the things that keeps me, even in my professional life, is how's the best way to put this? You know, I'm my own worst critic. So oddly enough, it's also helped me with, you know, no one's going to get 100% positive reviews. And it's helped me let those roll off my back, which was a big concern for me actually publishing, was to, you know, put yourself out there and put something you've put so much effort and for good or for bad, so much of yourself into. And one in particular would have really, I think, affected me had I not realized that what they were talking about wasn't my book. It was their expectations of what a book in the genre should be. So that mismatch made me go, okay, they're not actually unhappy with the book. They thought it was going to be, well, they thought it was going to be a romance, candidly. And that's not what I write.
Yeah, we've talked about that quite a bit on this show, about if you write a novel with gay characters, that there is an assumption out there that it is going to be either romance or erotica. A lot of times you get dinged for that because they make that assumption.
Yeah.
And I find it very frustrating.
Very true.
Yeah. I, on my first book on the Amazon page, I have right at the bottom, this is not a male romance novel. You will be disappointed if that's what you expect.
Because
of a couple of people that complained about that. And mm-hmm. I've even noticed some other writers. I remember reading one of Marshall Thornton's book and quite a few others on Goodreads where they have a book that has little to no romance at all. It's a good mystery. And even the good reviews sometimes will say, well, there's no romance, but, and then they talk about, you know, how good the book was. So,
well, we've wandered into something that has always, you know, okay. So after so many years of thinking I should write, or maybe I could write, you know, use those skills that I got in college, part of the thing that actually pushed me to do it is discovering, first and foremost, that, hey, people actually write books focused at the gay community. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, I was over the moon. Because what a great thing. And then I read, and I'm terrible about reading series. If there's a series out there, I'm going to read every stinking book in it, no matter how long it is, and I until I have a sense of completion there. And some of the very mainstream, you know, M for M books I read in quick sequence. And I realized very quickly that there was something that really bothered me about them. And don't get me wrong, the characterization, great. The plots, great. The settings, great. The writing itself, very good. You know, there's no fault in it. But I realized in the relationship of the characters, they were falling into a set pattern. And it was bothering me because it wasn't relevant to me. Didn't resonate. I'm like, well, that's not it, because I'm sorry. I have very few personal relationships or people that I know that where it's the tough, big alpha guy who's always a top, because there's always a fair amount of sex in it. And there's always the more feminine, weak, physically weaker, smarter, bottom. That's just like a trope. Mm-hmm. And I started realizing it was being used over and over again. And I can't help thinking, if that had been in a modern straight romance, people would dismiss it and say, well, that's not reality. That doesn't work for me. That's Harlequin from 1980.
Mm-hmm.
So they had just remodeled the, you know, a Harlequin romance with two men. And when I realized that was my dissatisfaction, I looked for something else. And I stumbled into a couple of authors that were, if romance is involved, it was much more realistic to me. And a lot of authors it wasn't about the sex per se, although there could be sex. That was not the focus. It was the mystery. It was the characters. It was relationships. And, you know, the top didn't always top and the bottom didn't always bottom. That's like, wow, real life. That's amazing. So
on the show, I have a rule. I say crime must be prime. And you can have plenty of sex and plenty of romance in the novel, but 51% of it has to be about the crime itself, or hopefully a little more than that. Because novels, mystery novels these days, unlike the past, you do get more into the character's life or your sleuth's life. And that is going to result in getting into their relationships and sometimes the sex. Mm-hmm. And a good writer, that it kind of just goes with the flow. But sometimes you can tell it's shoved in there because they think it needs to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say there's a handful of authors, and I will say you're among them. Like, your settings are very real to me. Like, I know where that is. I've seen that. And there's authenticity to it. Marshall Thornton, you know, the Boys Town, I don't know Chicago well. I know that era extremely well. And, like, you know, Martin McNeese and Murder at the Paisley Parrot, I completely know that. Like, I was there.
Yeah.
So those all have that ring to me. And people like Greg Ash. His small town setting, it raised the hair on the back of my neck because that's the small town I grew up in. It's the spitting image of Stillwater, Oklahoma. It's so weird for me. And that's how I actually got to know him, was by sending him admittedly a bit of fan mail. And he responded, which shocked the hell out of me. And I wound up reading a lot of his stuff and, you know, developing, I think, a good friendship with him. Mm-hmm. That really bolstered he really did urge me to write. I mean, I will say that he, and admittedly nagged me in some points, but he also was open enough to allow me to be a beta reader. And that just reminded me of how much I love writing and editing and those kind of things. So if you're listening, Greg, thanks.
Yeah, I kind of thought there was a story there where through reading through the lines between him just promoting your book, I felt like he kind of gave you a kick in the butt somewhere. I just got that feeling. Mm. So you didn't surprise
That's
me.
Totally true.
Yeah, you didn't surprise me.
And in fact, because of his, I mean, he has a huge following. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
He talked me up on his website, on his Facebook page. The day it launched, Fools was number one on Amazon, which I greedily screen captured and have kept that photo because it only lasted a day or two. But all the same, it was there.
It's awesome. For the readers out there, authors love to hear from you. And I think it's pretty rare that you won't get a response back. Sometimes our book goes out there and we wonder, we get the reviews, but we really wonder, have we affected anybody? So when somebody takes the time to send an email or fill out a contact page, it really can mean a lot.
Yeah, that I would can absolutely. I know that people have read the book. I mean, there's obviously sales, and hearing the there was another review that basically validated these. Like, oh yeah, I lived in San Diego at that time, and that's just brought back great memories for me. That's very gratifying. That's like the seal of approval. I don't care if you hated the plot, but if I evoke memories of a place and a time, I'm very happy with that.
Going back a little bit, it's going to be more about you than me, but that it's my show. Now, exactly. It actually kind of brings up what you talked about the alpha male and the whole domination, that sort of thing. In my first novel, there is a very brief sex scene. And the protagonist, Mitch, bottoms. And in a writing group I was in, one of the women in the group goes, that really surprised me. I kind of pictured Mitch as being a dominant man. And I said, who's to say the bottom isn't the dominant one?
It's a level of understanding. And look, I certainly don't want to say that straight people shouldn't read our books, because that's not what I'm saying. But there's a level of understanding that, you know, I'm not going to write lesbian fiction because I don't have that deep understanding. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could do it justice. And that level of authenticity that is just sometimes lacking. The fact that we're human And we lead a variety of life experiences. It's not just the same thing every time. I think that's really the success of gay fiction, is it's not just that we're being recognized or visible, because that was step one, shall we say. Now we're real people. And that the value of that, I think, can never be overestimated, because for us to make progress in the world, legal rights, civil rights, human rights, people have to recognize that we're more like them than not. And I think we're very close. I think we're also at risk of, you know, moving backwards if we don't keep our place in the public eye and make sure that people understand who we are and that we are their neighbors, and that we want the same things they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say it's a bit of a double-edged sword, because now that, you know, we don't have to have our safe places like we did 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, so many of them are disappearing.
Yeah.
And I guess it's what we've been fighting for, right? But it sure hurts to see them leave.
Yeah. Yep, I agree. We've had this discussion on the show quite a bit about there used to be the gay section of the bookstore. Now they're mingled in with all the other books. And it's really that way, right, in life now. They used to have your gay ghettos, and now everybody's mingled in. And there's a good part about that, but then there's a very negative part about it as well.
I think part of it is we do tend to lose a little bit of ourselves as a culture. But then again, we don't have to. We just have to, I think, keep an eye on it. And, you know, going mainstream is really what we wanted, I think.
Yeah.
But there's then again, I don't think we thought we'd be this successful. So it's a good problem to have, I guess.
Yeah. And one thing I want to actually correct myself on is when I told this woman, I said, well, you know, who's to say the bottom isn't the dominant one? I want to make it clear to people very frequently, and probably most of the time, neither is the dominant one. So,
right.
Didn't want to add that confusion to the mix.
It's very like that age-old cliche question, you know, who's the woman?
Oh.
Neither. We're both men.
It has been years since I've been asked that question, but I used to get asked that a lot. Which one of you is the woman?
Weird, right?
Yeah, and my answer was always, well, I'm a man and he's a man. That actually is what makes us gay.
Yeah, the simple logic there, right? Oh, right.
Yeah, I'm so glad I haven't heard that in a while. Probably because I moved to California.
And I moved away from California. So there we go.
And what brought you to, what took you from California to Toledo?
You know, primarily, and people have a hard time believing this, it was the house. We had decided, we've lived in the San Diego area, and all around San Diego County, and even, you know, into Riverside County, for so long. We've realized that, and we tell this joke all the time, so it's a little dry, but you can only barbecue at Christmas for so many years before you start to miss it. And also, you know, where we last bought, you know, when we were there for a little over 5 years. The first year we were there in July, it was over 110 degrees for almost 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then the following year, it wasn't in July, it was the end of June. And the next year, May, to the point where when we were packing up to leave for this, it was the end of March and we'd already hit over 100 degrees. So it's that spot. And I hate to be climate change being a primary motivator, but we couldn't see 10 years later and it being that hotter that long. I mean, you can only pipe in so much water. So we knew we wanted a change. We started looking around the country, and I'm very fortunate. My job allows me to be, anywhere that's near an airport or high-speed internet. And we just fell in love with a little town in Oregon, Astoria. It's where the Columbia River opens into the Pacific. And it's just this charming Victorian town with very modern people that are very friendly. We spent a week and a half there, after we had heard so many good things about it. And it lived up to its reputation in every way. But the nearest airport is either 3.5 hours to SeaTac or 3 hours to Portland, single-threaded highways. So I couldn't put my job at risk by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
As much as we loved it and, you know, all that. So then we started, you know, looking around the rest of the country to try and figure out some place that's progressive, some place that has at least two seasons, hopefully four. You know, there were all those criteria. And oddly enough, we got a marketing email from Zillow that showed, I think it was 10 houses or neighborhoods or towns, something like that, perfect for Oktoberfest. And there was a beautiful arts and crafts bungalow here in Toledo in a neighborhood called Old Orchard. And the college town, very near the water, all four seasons, and in the grand scheme of things, affordable. And we said, well, you know, let's do some research. And our home currently popped up as for sale, and we just couldn't believe it. It's a Georgian Revival. 1897, it was built by Judge Julian Tyler and his wife, Lily Heller Tyler. And it's one of the prominent homes in the Old West End, which is our historic district here. And the asking price for this house was just, we couldn't believe it. And so we actually made plans to come out. We were here in the winter just to make sure that it wasn't too much. And it wasn't. It was actually quite pleasant. And we just couldn't believe the neighborhood is inclusive. It's diverse. It's everything we wanted in a community. And we just couldn't pass on the house. So we made an offer and it was accepted and we moved across the country. All this, and I wish we had more time. I would tell you wonderful stories about the Tylers because they were just such characters. But I will say they didn't share a bedroom. They never had children.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge, that he dressed very stylishly and they've all but called him foppish in his obituary. And his wife was known as Tiger Lil for her temper. And supposedly her mother was haunting the guest room. So she moved into our home with Lily and Julian and died here in the 30s. So we were told that if you're ever sick or not feeling well or whatever, there's one particular bedroom that she'll come and sit on the bed with you and put a cool hand on your forehead. And she hasn't shown up yet.
Sounds like an awesome house. And if you don't write a novel where you eventually put your house in there, I'm going to drive to Toledo and slap you. Okay, so again, it's Fools Rush In by Austin Thomas Burton.
Mm-hmm.
Comes highly recommended, and you have another book coming out soon, so people should be looking for that, we'll say in the next 3 to 6 months.
Absolutely.
Well, it's been great talking with you.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure, Brad. Thank you so much for having me.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.